Hello, Western Wisconsin. Let's see what we're up to. Welcome to Spectrum West, everyone. I'm Al Ross. Good to be back. The Art Bench Trail is coming right along, and they're inviting you to do the same in communities on both sides of the St. Croix River Valley. Anastasia Sharton from the Phipps Center will fill us in on all the details on today's show. It's a fascinating book about how and why we talk the way we do in Wisconsin. It's so fascinating, we'll have to pick it up again on a later program, but today we'll meet a couple of the authors and get started on what it all means. Jim Oliver graces our airwaves with a report about the next Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production, the musical Annie Warbucks, opening at the State Theater in Eau Claire. The O Network will also bring us up to speed on what's on stage in West Wisconsin. That's the Oliver Network. And, you know, everyone likes birthday parties, don't they? Doesn't matter how old you are. The Northern Lakes Center for the Arts is 25 years old this year, and they're planning a big party for Friday evening. Director Lemoyne McLaughlin stopped by, and to kick off today's episode, I was marveling at how time flies when you're having fun. A quarter century already?
And people look at me and they say, well, it can't be.
Why? Yeah. We've heard the story before somewhere down the line as we've spoken. Remind me of the beginnings of the center.
Well, actually, the center began as an outgrowth of the Northern Lakes Chamber Orchestra, which was founded in 1985. And I think all of our listeners remember that in 1985, that was the tricentennial of Bach, Handel, and Scarlatti.
And if we didn't remember it, you just reminded us.
We wanted to do a series of concerts celebrating that historical event. So we formed this little chamber orchestra. And by 1989, we simply needed more space than local churches, which were providing the rehearsal and performance mm-hmm. spaces, were able to give us. And so we needed a place of our own. And there was a building that had been a local church in the community. It had been vacant for a couple of years. It had been sold as a church back about 1965 to the Ford dealership that changed tires and oil out of the back of the church. And then they sold it to a person who sold plumbing supplies, who sold it to a person who sold electrical supplies, who sold it to a person who was going to refurbish antiques down in the basement and then retail them upstairs. And we went to then a performance at the Colonial Church in Edina of the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, which is a very intimate setting. And as an old English teacher, I had directed theater in the round before, so we rethought the concept of stage. And our stage now is in the center of the building, and our audience is seated around us. And they don't come just to watch us. They come to participate with us and become one with the performers on the stage. And at the time, there were only two parties looking at the purchase of the building. There were ourselves and another group that wanted to turn it into a handball court, but they decided they didn't want to do that. And we then did purchase the building in 1989, and within 10 years, the building had been paid for. It's been just a wonderful ride over the last 25 years. One of the things that kind of concerned us at the very beginning was we were concerned that a little chamber orchestra would be able to support such an activity. And we had friends who were visual artists who were always looking for additional places to exhibit their work. There was a community theater group that had kind of disbanded because they didn't have any place to put costumes and sets off season. Mm-hmm. There were a number of writers in the area who wanted to come together and organize. So we thought approaching the community in a multi-artistic, multidisciplinary manner that we might be able to put enough people together to help pay for it. And that did work out. We have a very active chamber orchestra yet. We are performing this Saturday in our annual 4th of July concert, America, America. Mm-hmm. We have people who will be reading from famous documents in U.S. history, and then the audience will sing the favorite old patriotic hymns and tunes accompanied by the chamber orchestra. Wow. We've also got a very active theater guild. Our theater guild is working on performing Hamlet at the end of August. Yeah. There aren't very many community theaters who will tackle Hamlet, but this year is Shakespeare's 450th birth anniversary. And so we thought we should do something really major also. Hmm. So we're doing Hamlet. And then our local writers in the middle of July, we publish local writers' work twice a year. And they get together and read their work for the general public in the middle of July. We've also got Rimshots coming back from MacPhail Center for Music in Minneapolis in August. And I will be reading from my most recent book of poetry also. My point is we've got a lot of activities, different kinds of activities that go on. And although Amory is a very small community, fewer than 3,000 people, Amory also is very active athletically. I mean, we can't perform anything on Friday nights during the school year because there's always basketball or football or something going on. But, you know, and that's typical of a lot of small communities like that. But they have been very supportive of us because I think we do meet the need of local people, put that very high in terms of our priority, that we want to provide the highest quality service that we can. And I think we've done that for 25 years, and it has borne itself out financially.
So what you're saying is that Amory has artisans, but they're all in good shape because you say they're athletic.
Well, some of them are. Some of us eat too much and don't get enough exercise. One of the boasts that we make now after 25 years is that we have operated with 25 years of balanced budgets, and there aren't very many arts organizations nationally that can make that boast. And that's in a small community of fewer than 3,000 people.
So I think you should boast about that.
Okay.
In the studio with us, Lemoyne McLaughlin. He's artistic director and one of the founders and one of the visionaries of the Northern Lakes Center for the Arts in Amory. They're celebrating 25 years, and your birthday party is Friday evening. You have cake. What else?
Our mayor will be there, our city council administrators, city council members. And then Patrick Overton, who has been involved in Wisconsin over the years. He was originally living in Missouri and then moved out to Oregon, and now he's back in Missouri. But he's going to come back and visit us. He has worked with Arts Wisconsin, worked with the Wisconsin Arts Board, and we're pleased to have him back to celebrate with us.
Well, congratulations on 25 years.
Thank you.
It wouldn't be summer without a poem, a sonnet of sorts to praise the season, or maybe not. Maybe you have something sarcastic about summer. I don't know. But
no,
you're going to read something about summer.
I would be happy to read something.
We'd love it if you would.
This is from my most recent book of poems entitled A Song of Summer Rain. This is not a sonnet. It's actually a villanelle, which is an old medieval form from Italy and France, where the first and third lines of the first stanza are repeated in successive stanzas. Dylan Thomas, Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night, is the most famous English villanelle. Contemporary poets still use this form. This is A Song of Summer Rain. As darkness gathered at our window pane, and one by one the pleas of day denied, we listened to a song of summer rain. We watched the dimming daylight slowly strain and inch by inch beyond our vision slide as darkness gathered at our windowpane. Night's closing curtain forced sight to abstain from further focus, and as shadows died, we listened to a song of summer rain. Then evening breezes whispered their refrain in haunting harmony, which softly sighed as darkness gathered at our windowpane. And so, with dense clouds cloaking that domain where distant planets, moons, and stars reside, we listened to a song of summer rain. Years hence, this memory will still remain, how once, as tangled strings of life untied, and darkness gathered at our windowpane, we listened to a song of summer rain.
I had to read that, Dylan Thomas, poem once. Man, that was tough. I listened to Anthony Hopkins do his version to get an idea of what it would sound like.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light.
Well, again, happy birthday, Lemoyne. And you said a lot of we's during your historical rendition of where the Northern Lakes Center for the Arts came from. So I'm sure you want to publicly thank all the we's that have helped you do it.
I would love to do that. I mean, clearly my wife and I work very closely together. We've also got a very active and supportive board of directors. And then, of course, there's the community. Everyone from the mayor to the city council to the school administrators, the school teachers, they've all been very supportive of what we've done, and we're very appreciative of that support.
birthday serenade from the Spectrum West Orchestra. Ladies and gentlemen, we don't get to call on them often because they're expensive. They all play for union scale. So just for very special occasions, and the 25th birthday of the Northern Lakes Center for the Arts is just that special. So congratulations, everybody in Amory, and here's to many more.
Here's what's on stage in Western Wisconsin theater venues. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild will present Annie Warbucks, the continuing story of Annie, tonight, Thursday, through Sunday at the State Theater in Eau Claire. Magic Treehouse, Dinosaurs Before Dark, will be staged tonight, Thursday, and Friday by the Eau Claire Children's Theater at the Oxford Theater in Eau Claire. The Great River Shakespeare Festival will stage The Merry Wives of Windsor, Friday and Sunday, and Hamlet, Saturday and Monday, at the theater on the campus of Winona State University. The Boogeyman's Apprentice, a Theater in the Woods youth production, will be staged Friday through Sunday at the Erica Kwan Memorial Theater in Shell Lake. The Festival Theater of St. Croix Falls will present A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum through Sunday. Flanagan's Wake, an interactive comedy, will play through Sunday at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. The Red Barn Theater production of Foxfire will run through Saturday at the theater in Rice Lake. Les Miserables will be staged through Sunday at the Northern Star Theater in Rice Lake. That Love and Feelin', the story of the Righteous Brothers, will play Friday and Saturday at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. The show will play Fridays and Saturdays and selected Sundays through August 9th. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver.
Support for WPR comes from the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild presenting Annie Warbucks, the musical comedy based on the comic strip Orphan and her adventures in New York, June 26th through 29th at Eau Claire State Theater. Tickets are available at cvtg.org.
It's Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Thanks for being with us this week. It all began back in 2006, even earlier, because that's when the first bench took shape and started accepting posteriors. What bench, you say? The art benches that are linking communities up and down the lower St. Croix Valley. We introduced the concept a few months back in a conversation with Anastasia Sharton, the visual arts director at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. And since many of the benches will see and accept festive human activity this summer, and another is about to emerge, we placed a follow-up call to Hudson. Well, the idea, as I noted, all began 8 years ago. Were you there when that started?
Oh, yes.
Oh, cool. What were those meetings like?
Let's see. 8 years ago would have been 2006, and that's actually when the first bench was unveiled.
Yeah.
There were many meetings and many conversations that preceded that that led up to the idea of the bench project. Those conversations happened with groups of artists, groups of other community members, really facilitated through a series of conversations and book discussions and gatherings that the Phipps and the St. Croix Valley Foundation and the University of Wisconsin River Falls Institute for Sustainable Community Development sponsored together. So it's always been very collaborative, very St. Croix Valley-based, and really interdisciplinary.
Mm-hmm. When that first bench was unveiled, you knew there were going to be more. That was the plan.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
And actually, that first year, we had the bench in St. Croix Falls, the bench in Bayport, and the bench in Hudson underway, all in different, you know, each bench project has a life of its own. It just so happened that the one in St. Croix Falls was finished first, and then the one in Bayport was finished next, and then Hudson. But the initial conversations with those communities began simultaneously.
We last spoke in January when most everything, including benches and parks, was in a deep freeze.
Yeah.
But I will surmise that thoughts and imaginations were warm and active on taking this to the next level. First, bring me up to speed on where all the benches are. Last time we talked, there were seven.
There are still seven completed benches. They are in St. Croix Falls, Somerset, Hudson, and Prescott in Wisconsin. They're in Carpenter Nature Center, which is kind of between Hastings and Afton, in Bayport, and Marine on St. Croix in Minnesota. Now, there's an eighth bench that is in the works currently in Osceola. There's a group of 12 summer school students in grades 4 through 8 who are working with artist David Markson and also their teacher, Amy Klein. And they have been exploring Osceola both through the history. They've been working with the local historical society as well as through the natural environment. They took a tour with a board member from Standing Cedars. We actually also went out on the river one day in canoes. They have been just really thinking and exploring and learning as much as they can about Osceola. Mm-hmm. And this week, they are in the design phase. So on Friday, we're going to have a gathering where the design for the bench will be unveiled.
Now, these aren't just benches made out of 2x4s, but they're pretty ornate and they are imaginative and exquisite, but they all can be sat on.
Oh, yes, okay. Yes. They are each, as you said, very unique, all different materials from, you know, large pieces of granite to mosaic to poured concrete, you know, that's formed, mm-hmm. to steel. Not sure what the bench in Osceola is going to be made out of. I'm very much looking forward to showing up on Friday and seeing what they come up with. But each of them is functional and yet sculptural and meant to, through their form and through the details on the bench as well, meant to communicate something about the place where they are, the town that they're in, the village they're in, the physical location that they're in. And mm-hmm. so many of them have words, many of them have images, and then just the form themselves can sort of speak to an idea.
We're on the telephone with Anastasia Sharton. She's Visual Arts Director at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson, getting a refresher course. And then we'll jump into a few more things. The Art Bench Trail, which is in the St. Croix Valley. It's pretty unique. We're going to talk about Riverfest 2, which is upcoming. There's a website now, Anastasia. It's artbenchtrail.org. What can we learn there?
I'm actually quite proud of that website.
Good for you. You should be.
Thank you. There's obviously a map that can get you to the different benches. And then there are pages about each of the benches. And I worked with Greg Seitz, who's a local champion of the St. Croix River. And he wrote stories about each of the benches, interviewed some of the people that were involved in each of the benches, kind of went back, you know, historically and contacted people, and so wrote these really great short stories about how the benches developed and what the kind of messages are and what inspired the people involved in those. So that's a really great resource. There's also a page with different activities that are suggested that you could do at all the benches, activities that you could do at each of the benches. There's a link to various events that are going on. You know, we've created this trail that people can go on themselves. Mm-hmm. And we've got brochures that are all around at tourism centers. And we've dropped off at libraries. And of course, you know, here at the Phipps and at the National Park Service headquarters would be two ideal places to pick these up. And then each of the benches themselves, either we've got a box there or there's a building just adjacent to the bench where you can pick up a brochure. So we can go on this trail, and we encourage people to do it just self-guided, a great way to explore the towns in the St. Croix Valley. There are all trails adjacent to many of the benches, just really great, unique sites. So it's a great way to get outdoors, to get out into the valley and explore. But then also we've encouraged each of the bench site communities to develop an event, a gathering that would happen at their benches. There are a couple coming up. A couple have already happened. There's lots of different ways of exploring the art.
Well, in July, the 12th through the 17th, it's Riverfest in Hudson. What bench-related activities are there within that?
Yeah, well, there are activities in Hudson's Lakefront Park that are going on. That website is stcroixriverfest.org. Mm-hmm. And the majority of events are happening right here in Lakefront Park. And the art bench is in Lakefront Park. It's in Picnic Point, which is just at the south end of Lakefront Park by the boat launch. And then there's also a great playground that's down there, too. So just coming to any event here in Lakefront Park during Riverfest, you'd have the opportunity to visit the bench. But then on Tuesday, July 15th, we are highlighting the bench and that location by having a Native American celebration. The Native American youth dancers performing at 7 o'clock, the Trails Dance Troupe, Traditions Respecting American Indian Lifestyles. So it's a youth group that will be performing. And then as a special treat, Medallion the Stallion, this Indian Summer Festival Painted Pony Road Show,
ooh,
is going to be at Picnic Point as well. Again, just to complement, you know, the Native American celebration. This is a life-size replica of a horse that is literally on the road, and they're bringing it to this event where kids of all ages can paint on the horse, and then also they'll have other art-making activities to learn more about the importance of the horse in Native American culture.
Isn't that what the people were told about the Trojan horse, too, that it was, it was going to be fun, but it didn't turn out that way?
Oh, yeah, no, we're not fooling anyone here.
Yours will be fine. Yeah, Saturday, July 12th, and Prescott's also a big day, isn't it?
Prescott has the butterfly bench. They built a bench at the same time that they were putting in a butterfly garden. That bench is a mosaic bench, all made of handmade tiles. John Tarullo was the artist who facilitated that, working with a group of 4-H students and ecology club members from the high school and volunteers from Freedom Park as well. Going along, again, that theme of the butterfly garden and tying in to that bench and learning more about the role that gardens and flowers have, there's going to be a really fun activity, Paint a Flying Flower. Susan Carmody is going to teach that. It's for students ages 6 and up. It's free for the first 16 participants. It starts at 10 o'clock on the 12th of July, and people just have to call the Great River Road Visitor and Learning Center at Freedom Park in order to register.
Yeah. We've all seen, Anastasia, pieces of art, you know, in metro areas, you know, hands, and there have been bowls and themes, et cetera. Where do you go from here? How many communities can have benches eventually?
That's a good question. At this point, as you know, we have committed to 8. I have been in conversation with quite a few communities, especially since we've launched the Art Bench Trail, different communities in the Lower St. Croix River Valley here who are interested in putting benches in. I actually think that it's limitless. You can have these benches. We could even have multiple benches in communities. Yep. Mm-hmm. As well, you know, just different groups coming together. And again, you know, the idea of this bench project is to create a gathering place, to create a place where people can come together. That's, you know, kind of the beauty of a bench. It's made for more than one person to sit on, and then also placed in locations that community members want to invite people to. So there are multiple locations in each of our communities that we love and appreciate and admire and want people to come to. So it really is limitless. I do believe that if in a couple of years you and I reconnect, and I wouldn't be surprised if we have 10 or 12 benches at that point.
I'm not waiting a couple of years.
Oh, okay.
I can't do that. I'm too curious.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you, Al.
You've started something big, and it sounds like fun, and this phone conversation's been fun. Anastasia, thanks for being with us.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Anastasia, what a great name. Charton. I told her so. She's in charge of visual arts at the fabulous Phipps Center in Hudson, and this huddle was all about the Art Bench Trail, 7, soon to be 8 grand benches to commemorate and celebrate life in the St. Croix Valley. You want more? Go to artbenchtrail.org, and your appetite will be serensified. Here's a Spectrum memo. The Ludington Guard Band performs their annual Patriotic Independence Day concert Tuesday night, July 1st, beginning at 8 p.m., featuring the Menominee Singers. Also, the 1812 Overture features a live cannon volley. Wow. White Pine Ramblers will perform during intermission. There's more, of course. It's all at the Wilson Park Bandshell in Menominee. Hey, you know, a lot of books cross our desks here at WPR. Many are read and enjoyed, while others are educated and add it to our overall effect. One such book is Wisconsin Talk, Linguistic Diversity in the Badger State, a project and a product of a rather large collaboration of educators, spearheaded by a trio of UW-Madison English and Foreign Language professors, Eric Ramey, Joe Selmans, and Tom Purnell. In a lot of ways we talk in Wisconsin, these guys love to notice it, study it, appreciate it, and now write about it. We joined Ramey and Selmans on the phone earlier this week. We've all heard the line, we are what we eat. This alters those a bit by saying we are what we say. If we talked about all the minutiae within the book, all the research and findings and details, we'd be on the phone for a long time. So let's just work to satisfy my curiosity about a few things, and I'm acting as a representative of our listeners. Now, this is what you do for a living. One of you, or both of you, define a linguist for us.
This is Joe Selmans.
This is Joe Selmans, okay.
Linguistics is the scientific study of language, and that is as broad and rich and complicated as it sounds. Some people are literally doing brain science, neurology of language.
Oh, really?
Taking people in functional magnetic resonance imaging machines and seeing what lights up when they say or hear certain things. Some people are studying the speech organs, how they produce sounds, how we hear sounds, how we process what we hear. Some people are doing sentence structure. Some people are doing incredibly old school, what's called philology, working with ancient texts, trying to figure out what was going on, how languages have changed since then. Mm-hmm. It's everything. It's humanities, social sciences, biological sciences, and even physical sciences. Basically, it really covers sort of everything from medieval studies up to really current hard science. There's a whole lot of sociolinguistics in the book, so sort of how language interacts with society, that's really relevant to regional language, obviously.
Was this an epiphany that just went off among the three of you, or did one of you start as the instigator and get other people involved? And when and how did you decide it was great fodder for a book? And I say that because it's both a good coffee table book and it's also a textbook in many ways.
I actually used it last semester as a textbook, and it worked really well. I've been at UW the longest. This is Joe again. I had started working on immigrant languages in Wisconsin, especially German. Still lots of German speakers around, and I started interviewing them to figure out what kind of German they spoke and whether their English was influenced by their German and so forth. Tom Purnell came a few years later, and we started talking about what was going on there. He's really, of the three of us, the one who's most into the speech science, the hardcore phonetic end of things. And we had been batting around some ideas. And a student from Germany wrote the linguistics department and said, I'm interested in maybe coming to UW, and I study phonetics, and I speak German and English, and I wonder if there are any projects. Well, for me and Tom, this was just perfect because we had been thinking about whether there were influences of German on the way that English is spoken in the state today. She came and we started working on old recordings and new recordings of people from eastern Wisconsin and looking at one really specific thing. In English, we distinguish between a word like his, something that belongs to a male, and hiss, the sound that a cat, an angry cat, makes. In German, you don't. Both of those words would be pronounced hiss. In fact, that's a feature of a German accent in English. That's his book. And we started looking at whether that was something that was left over from German immigrants in eastern Wisconsin. We found something that just stunned us. We have recordings, thanks to the earlier linguists who've worked here, made back in the early 1950s, people born in the mid-19th century, late 19th century. So we took recordings of people born in different years, all the way up to people who are young now. And we thought, well, okay, so they just never lost the German accent. So these guys in eastern Wisconsin, it's the same situation in of western Wisconsin, too. They always just said his instead of his. And it turns out the earliest speakers, the oldest speakers, actually made the distinction really, really clearly. What happened is that it's only younger speakers who are losing the distinction. So this feature that was there in the speech of bilinguals sort of gets overcome by the bilinguals. They work really hard to sound English-like, and over time, English speakers sort of come back around to sounding more German. They readopt what was an earlier feature of speech in their area. So we started working on that, and when Eric came, we started looking at and thinking about the broader issues, and it just kind of exploded, but that's the beginning.
That's the voice of Joe Selmans. On an extension is Eric Ramey. They are both educators in the English department at UW-Madison, and we're talking about the book Wisconsin Talk, Linguistic Diversity in the Badger State. For the record, Wisconsin's big three, as far as heritage goes, are German, Polish, and Norwegian. I noted language doesn't have state lines. We might, in Wisconsin, be uncomfortable to know that we have a lot in common with Vikings and Bears fans. Eric, your specific chapter is about standard English. I was intrigued by how people in different parts of America perceive how others talk, either correctly or pleasantly, including a look at how people in Eau Claire, and that's in our wheelhouse, perceive the way others in Wisconsin talk. What does our perception of how other people talk teach a guy like you?
What I tried to do in that chapter is to demonstrate that, you know, there's not really any one answer to what standard is. Is that it's very much like, you know, home field advantage. You know, here in Wisconsin, people don't really bat their eyes if you say beg for bag,
sure,
or you say the past tense of dive is dove, or you have a difference between caught, C-O-T, and caught, C-A-U-G-H-T, because that's Wisconsin. But if you go into other parts of the country and other English speech communities, people will pull it, whoa, what are you doing there? That's weird.
Yeah.
And we don't really ever notice that, you know, we're thinking that this other person is doing something weird in any sort of kind of a relativistic way. And it's not that this is just kind of, you know, hippy-dippy, touchy-feely, relativistic stuff. This is just really the facts of the matter. It's good to have a really, really, really strong, good Wisconsin accent when you're up in Whitefish, right? Not so much in Atlanta, Georgia. In Atlanta, Georgia, you want a nice, strong Southern accent.
No, people down there talk funny.
Everybody talks funny.
Sure.
Because you just got to see who, you know, who's making the judgment for this. And so this also plays in with kind of just our unconscious or unquestioned views about education and other things, is that, you know, everybody has this idea that there is some sort of standard English. You know, you get taught this in school. That's really what the kind of the question about who speaks the most correct in asking people to make this judgment. This is really more of a proxy about, you know, how educated do you think a person sounds? Mm-hmm. And so the Michigan people thought the Michigan people sounded the most educated, and then the Southerners were the least educated, is really what that question was about. And many people are not conscious that this is what they're doing when they make judgments on how someone talks. You know, this is really, you know, prejudice on language is one of the last unchecked bastions of prejudice. It's polite conversation to comment about how someone sounds stupid or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. In our society, in our minds, good talkers, they're perceived as educated. But a good example of one who's educated but doesn't sound educated is James Carville.
Yeah. Also, Ted Turner. I mean, so you know, Jimmy Carter had a Southern accent. And there's, you know, many people feel that, like, a lot of the disrespect for President Carter at the time was connected to having a Southern accent as opposed to a Northern accent.
And why is it that all you have to do is apply a British accent and the person suddenly seems intelligent?
That's a really interesting point, because there are features that are shared by some Southern dialects, by African-American English, and by British English that in the context of a British accent sound completely posh.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Southern English and African-American English sound extremely non-standard. And that's the R-lessness, the not pronouncing R's at the ends of words.
Sure.
You know, if you say pa-ka-ka with a British accent, it's fancy. And if you say it with one of those other accents, it's emphatically not fancy.
You spoke of teaching standard English, which for elementary teachers is tough to begin with, because kids arrive in school with what's called vernacular or informal standard already planted, because mm-hmm. that's what they're speaking in their home.
Yeah, well, no, like one of the interesting things is that from people who have looked at kind of that type of situation, taking advantage of the local vernaculars that the kids come with and using kind of a comparative method is actually quite effective in teaching the standard.
Okay.
If kids don't know that the way that they're talking is different than how people want them to,
yeah.
you know, so like this is the standard, this is your thing, trying to correct them, the kids view it as punitive and just arbitrary. People don't explain to them, like, you know, this is how you do it, you know. Whereas it appears that if people take a, you know, the teachers take a comparative way of, like, comparing, like, okay, you know, at home you may talk about this, them, these, and those, but in here you want to say this, them, these, and those. And a comparative way, kids are very, very smart with language, and they can understand and see the difference. And then, you know, this changes kind of the discussion about language and the judgments about language as to kind of, you know, these prejudiced quality decisions mm-hmm. about how you talk to something more like, you know, if you're going to a fancy place, you dress up. If you're going to do, you know, an interview with a corporate job, you want to dress up and wear a coat and tie. And, like, changing the language that one has is really equivalent to that, is that, you know, you want to match the language you have to the situation that you're in. You know, the language you're going to use interviewing for their job
sure.
is not the same thing you're going to be using when you're watching a Packers game.
I always thought that teaching English was frustrating because you're sending them back out there knowing they're not going to use that. But I suppose if you've taught them correctly, they will use it in the right situations.
Yeah, that's the whole thing, is that, you know, the more a person knows about language and different varieties about language, mm-hmm. the more effective they can be in using it in different circumstances. Yeah. And, you know, whether the circumstance is, you know, talking with a client or writing a memo for a corporation or pitching to a corporate board or anything like that,
sure.
you know, all of these different things, if you know about language and you're smart about it, you can do things with it. You're going to want to use the most standard speech you have when you're doing the pitch to the corporate board. But, you know, afterwards, if you're at dinner and you find out that one of the board members is from Rhinelander and you're from up north too, all of a sudden showing that you have that language variety available to you can be a very strong bonding moment.
We've been talking at least this past segment with Eric Ramey. He's on the phone along with Joseph Selmans. They're educators at UW-Madison, along with Tom Purnell of Written Wisconsin Talk, Linguistic Diversity in the Badger State. We should point out that there are many other contributors to the book, too, many colleagues at UW-Madison. In West Wisconsin, the word, and you mentioned this in the book, the word them is used a lot to replace they, as in them are the best or them are the biggest tomatoes I've ever seen. That's fairly common in Wisconsin. It's a good example of how the everyday can trump time spent in an English classroom.
One of the things we want to recognize is that, and we don't fully understand why this is the case, but there's kind of two types of words.
Mm-hmm.
One of the words are like lexical words, and these are nouns, adjectives, verbs. They are the things that really kind of have meaning, and it's very easy to learn those types of words throughout your life, you know? So, mm-hmm. like, nobody was freaked out when they had to learn, you know, to tweet and Twitter.
Sure.
There's another set of words that are called functional words, and these are things like prepositions, pronouns, auxiliary verbs. And if you've ever learned a second language, these are the ones that are the most brutal to learn. Learning the prepositions in a foreign language is just very difficult.
Okay.
There's just something just fundamentally different about the words and how people learn them and how they exist in language. The example that you have is a pronoun. It's a demonstrative pronoun. And so you're going to learn how to use these things when you're very young, growing up in the speech community that you have. And then when you go to school and you're exposed to standard English and this kind of different pronoun system, that's one of the most difficult things to switch off. You know, this is another one of these, you know, the shibboleths of education is like, as you said, like how do you speak English if you make this mistake? Well, for those speakers of English, it's not a mistake. You understand what they're saying. You know, there's no difficulty in understanding or what they're doing. It's just a very slightly different form that we're extremely sensitive and noticing it. And when people do that, the idea that this person is not like me really pops up in the head. And I think that's really why we have such a strong, you know, judgment to these really small little nitpicky
sure.
facts about language, if people have them, is that when somebody does something different in one of these areas, we really notice it as like, hold it, that's not how I behave.
You talk in the book about particles as well, words like with and up, little stragglers on the ends of sentences, bring with, take with, go with. Or I think I'll stir that up. Today with technology, the word out gets put in there because we keep saying, I will print that out.
Oh, okay.
You
yeah,
know?
I haven't noticed that one yet, but yes.
No, you're just going to print that. You're not going to print that out.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm just a jerk. Hey, so, here's...
Yeah, no, the particles are really interesting because to me, they strike me as like, they look like prepositions, so they should be these functional things that should be hard for people to learn. But it seems to me people are very plastic in learning these particle things
mm-hmm.
because I didn't grow up with like the with construction. But now since I've moved here to Wisconsin in 2006, I use it all the time. So that's something that I've picked up by me picking up this local dialectical feature. This tells me from, you know, my armchair, you know, psychology that I'm very happy being here because I picked up local features.
Mm-hmm. Joe, you're kind of the expert on the international side. I've always wondered, when people relocate, they pick up dialects and phrases. Is there any research that tells us how long that takes, or is that kind of person to person?
Well, it's in part person to person. It's also in part what's being picked up. Like Eric said, there are certain things that are much easier to learn than other things. When people move to the South, I'm from the South originally, and when people from the North move to the South, they pick up y'all very quickly
yes.
often. Just like Eric says, you know, like it's a sign, oh, I like being here. I'm kind of adjusting to the way that you do things. But people will miss how y'all actually work. So you pick it up, but you don't use it the way that a native speaker does. So in the South, if somebody walks up to me on the street and says, "What are y'all doing tonight?" It's clearly about me and somebody else. It's plural. But it's not uncommon for people from the North to just use y'all as if it meant you, singular y'all. That usually is overcome pretty quickly. Certain things of pronunciation are almost impossible to adjust for. One of the things that I have as a Southerner, having moved north, is I don't distinguish between pin, P-I-N, and pin, P-E-N. That's just very hard to learn, and it's exactly like what Eric's talking about with the sort of more grammatical aspects. There are certain sound patterns that are difficult to acquire as an adult. So the things that certain things you can unlearn, certain things are very hard to unlearn. Certain things you pick up on as features that flag you in some way that you don't necessarily want to be noticed. My wife grew up in Madison, went to college and graduate school in California. As soon as she got to California, she tried to get rid of Wisconsin pronunciations, like the long O sound and the long A sound, words like day and O and words like boat, so that not every conversation started with, "Oh, where in the world are you from? Why do you talk that way?" And she did it, but certain other things she never lost. For R-O-O-M, she says room and not room, and broom and not broom. That was apparently not salient enough for people to pick up on and for her to get rid of. So it's very variable depending on what the structure is and what the social awareness of it is.
I'm going to suggest that people listening pick up a copy of the book, Wisconsin Talk, Linguistic Diversity in the Badger State. It's available at what, UW Press?
Yeah, it's from University of Wisconsin Press.
You know what I want to do is I want to pick this up and talk to you guys again someday because it's so fascinating stuff. I mean, you guys talk about bubbler, which I grew up with. You talk about pop and soda. Pop is a Western thing. Soda's in the East. One final question in this particular segment. Are you guys, or yous guys, able to instantly pinpoint where someone lives after conversing with them for a bit? Are you that good?
No. That is some sort of parlor trick. People who are very good at that pick up on particular features that they look at. I think amongst Tom, Joe, and myself, we could be pretty good if we could listen to someone talk for a while and maybe get it to like a quarter of the state.
I would just add to that we can't do that listening to you, but if we record you and take it back to the lab, which is now the office,
sure,
and analyze it for a while, we can pretty much figure it out. So a lot of the stuff that's happening is below the radar. It's stuff that that we don't pick up on consciously, but it's there in the speech signal.
There's so much of what we can talk about that I hope you guys will consent to doing it again. Interestingly enough, I was at the College World Series last week over in Omaha. I was sitting among a whole bunch of Ole Miss fans. There was a guy up to bat, and this guy kept yelling, "Come on, Jim!" And I never thought Jim was a two-syllable word. You know,
it's called the Southern vowel shift.
I will leave it at that profound bit of education, the Southern vowel shift. Now, they'll be back because there's a lot of who we are left to investigate. Eric Ramey and Joe Salmons, 66% of the trio who published Wisconsin Talk, Linguistic Diversity in the Badger State. Again, it's available at University of Wisconsin Press. And if you pick it up, why not let us know if you have any specific questions for the next time those guys are here, okay? Okay.
Support for WPR comes from Visit Winona, home of the Winona County History Center, with special summer exhibitions including The Art of Fine Furniture 2014. It's the year to discover Winona. Visit Winona.com.
This is Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Al Ross. It is wonderful having you along. And it's good to have Jim Oliver along for the ride again this week. Let's see what premieres Western Wisconsin has in our near future.
Annie Warbucks is a musical with a book by Thomas Meehan, music by Charles Struess, and lyrics by Martin Charnon. The sequel to the 1977 Tony Award-winning musical Annie, it's based on Harold Gray's Little Orphan Annie comic strip and begins immediately after Annie ended. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production of Annie Warbucks opens tonight, Thursday, and runs through Sunday at the State Theater in Eau Claire. Michelle Langhow is the director of the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production and joins us to talk about the musical. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Why, thank you.
You told me this is your first time as a director of a musical or any other play, I guess. So let's talk about, in the first place, what caused you to be bitten by the addiction that we call community theater.
You know what? I have gone to shows for years and years. I have friends that are spectacular singers, so I've enjoyed musicals since as long as I can remember. When I moved back to Eau Claire about 10 years ago, I got a little more involved behind the scenes with the theater. And I've been in a few shows. I've helped my brother-in-law, Mike Cook, who has done lots of directing. And I decided it was time to take the plunge and see what I could do as the director, and I'm enjoying it.
Talk a little bit about some of the plays that you've been in.
Yeah, I've been, you know, chorus here and there. One of my favorite roles was back in 2010, and probably my biggest role. I did Always Patsy Cline. There's one role that somebody always says that's your favorite. That will always be my favorite. I did a couple of shows out at Fanny Hill with Don Hodgins, mm-hmm. and that was a lot of fun. And I learned a lot from Don. Don is an amazing director and expert of anything with keeping a show moving and farce. And so I've learned a lot from him as well.
Well, tell us about Little Orphan Annie and the show.
You know, a lot of people don't know this show. It doesn't have the songs The Sun Will Come Up Tomorrow and Hard Knock Life, but it has just spectacular songs in it. Our music director, Meg Gazella, is working with the cast on the songs. And I said, you might not know them, but as people are walking out of the theater, they will be singing the songs. They're a lot of fun. This show starts right at the very end of Annie. Annie ends at the Christmas scene, and we start right at the Christmas scene at the beginning of Annie Warbucks.
What happens after the end of Annie? Don't tell us the whole
story. Oh, I won't give away, because it's, you know, we all think that Annie is just going to live happily ever after, and we find out in Annie Warbucks she still has a few things that she's going to have to deal with. And the neat thing about this show, we have some characters that aren't there. Miss Hannigan is in the first show. She's not in this show. But we have some pretty good characters who are the antagonists. I'm not really even going to reveal who those are, but we have a lot of new characters. We have a Commissioner Doyle. We have a Mrs. Kelly. We have a wonderful family from Tennessee with the daughter, C.G., who's played by Marley Anderson, who just does a great job with that. And Annie befriends them to help her figure out whether or not she should go home. She's afraid that when Daddy Warbucks gets married, he might not want her anymore.
Mm, well, that's always a little bit of a pickle, isn't it? Tell us the names of some of the songs that we may not necessarily be familiar with, but we'll notice if we go see the show.
Well, the show starts with Annie Just Ain't Annie Anymore, and that is what's happening. She's now been adopted. At least we think she's been adopted, but we find out it's a legal adoption. And that is the opening number, which gets everybody going. A Younger Man is one that Bob Sessions is. He's our Daddy Warbucks. It's a great song, kind of wishing he was a younger man in this situation. Sophie McCutcheon plays Annie, and she obviously got a lot of solos. She works through the whole show. She's a 10-year-old who has the spunk absolutely of Annie. It's not much of a push for her to be Annie, and she also happens to have naturally red hair. She does a great job with her songs. Changes is a really nice song. There's The Other Woman that is also a wonderful song.
She is Michelle Langhow, who is director of the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production of Annie Warbucks. Well, you mentioned a couple of the principal characters and actors. Are there more?
One of the returning, of course, obviously, is Daddy Warbucks and Grace Farrell. Those are back. Annie, we've got Tessie and Pepper and Molly, which were in the original show for the orphans. But we've added Peaches, who is played by Irene Unger. And I think I already told you Commissioner Doyle and Mrs. Kelly. And we have Simon Whitfield, who is the attorney. And the family from Tennessee is great. Ella, Elvin, and CG. So you add those people in with the original characters, and it's a fun mix.
Mm-hmm. Now, who are the actors who play? You mentioned Bob Sessions and the...
Bob Sessions is Daddy Warbucks. We have Megan Bauer, who is Grace Farrell. And then our Tennessee family, Elvin, is played by Josh Thomas Murray. Ella is played by Carrie Bodenberg. CG is played by Marley Anderson. Mrs. Kelly, who is played by Meg Gazella. And Commissioner Doyle is played by Kristen Wolukas. And her daughter is also one of the orphans in the show. So that's another thing with community theater that's fun, that when you can put a mother and a daughter or, you know, some sort of family members together in a show.
Now, let's go on to the technical crew, which I'm sure you found out, if you didn't know before, is vitally important to any kind of a production. Who is your musical director?
Our musical director is Meg Gazella, and I have worked with her before on another show, and she is also in the show. She's kind of pulling double duties.
Mm-hmm. Is there a choreographer?
Josh Thomas Murray is our choreographer, mm-hmm. and again, I've worked with him, and he's now kind of a veteran at the Theater Guild with that.
How about set designers and sound designers, lighting, all that stuff?
Karen Fenimore is going to be the light designer. Kevin Kruger is building our set. I drew the setup, and he took what I had, and I said, I can draw it, but I can't make it. So he's making it. And then a young gal, Allie Collins from the university, is doing all the specialty painting. And then she has some helpers. There's people who can do the rollers, and there's people who can do the neat things, and she's doing the neat things.
Very important stuff. Well, we've been visiting with Michelle Langhow, director of the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production of Annie Warbucks. The show opens tonight, which is Thursday, and runs through Sunday at the State Theater in Eau Claire. For ticket information, contact the Theater Guild at 715-832-PLAY. Michelle Langhow, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you, Jim. Spectrum Memo at the Mabel Tainter in Menominee this weekend, Friday, Saturday. It's the Gales of November, a dramatic musical about the Edmund Fitzgerald. Here's the lineup for outdoor concerts. Tuesday night, Blues, Owen Park in Eau Claire, July 1st, Left Wing Bourbon. Right, music starts 6:30. Thursday night, that's tonight, the Sounds Like Summer Concert Series at Phoenix Park. Eau Claire presents Dames, Turpentine Wine, and Hannah Connolly. From UW Eau Claire next Monday at Owen Park, music by Licio, and Wednesday, catch the movie Jaws on the lawn west of the Haas Fine Arts Center. Chill on the Hill at UW River Falls continues Tuesday, July 1st, featuring, yes, the kids from Wisconsin. Wow. Thursday night, tonight, if you're listening on Thursday, at Memorial Park in Ladysmith, the Music in the Park series presents Steve Seidel, the Altoona Cowboy. Yeehaw. That's going to put a ribbon around this edition of Spectrum West. Coming up next time, that's next week, Gillian Welch comes to Eau Claire and we'll do the introduction with some music, hopefully a chat. UW students created documentary has gotten some national recognition. Jim Oliver on a book by a regional author with an Eau Claire setting. We'll visit the Mabel Tainter during rehearsal of their next offering, which is The Last 5 Years. We'll remember a true art original and more. I'm Al Ross. Thanks for being with us. We really appreciate it here at Wisconsin Public Radio. See you next week.